We're rolling.
Okay.
Could you please tell me your name and occupation?
Yes. My name is Ana Maria Schwartz Caballero, and I'm a professor of Spanish and second language education at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, UMBC.
And where were you born?
I was born in Cuba. I was born in Havana, Cuba, and I came to the States when I was an adolescent. So.
Can you tell me a little bit about your family? Who are your parents? What did they do? Do you have siblings?
My parents are deceased. They were in Miami. I have one sister who's in South Carolina. We come from a middle class family, but my father was an entrepreneur, so we lived well. He lost all the business that he had built up when he came to the States, but still managed to start another small business, and that's how we survived in the States. So we didn't all come together. I came first and went to live with family in New York. My sister came second, and then my mother and my father was the last one who left because he was having some difficulties leaving the island, and then we all moved to Miami. So.
So you guys all met up in New York, and then you went together to Miami?
Well, the three, my mom, my sister, and myself, did live in New York at my mom's sister's and her family. But my father, when my father came, he, you know, obviously came to New York to see us, but then he established himself in Miami, and we moved there when I finished high school. So,
when you think about your time in Cuba growing up in Havana, what makes you smile?
Family, and that's what I really miss in the States. We our Sundays, the family got together and we were all there. And once we came to the States, the family just settled in different places. So I have relatives in, as I said, South Carolina with my sister. But in Virginia, in New York, in Florida, in Texas, and it's not the same thing, and that makes me. It's a wistful smile. Yeah.
So. Did you grow up speaking Spanish and English?
I grew up speaking Spanish, but I went to a bilingual school in Havana, so I did learn English from the first grade on. So I was very lucky, and my sister also, in that respect, because when we came to the States, we already had English, but Spanish was the language of our home. Yeah.
Do you remember when you were young? Do you remember what you wanted to be when you grew up? What did you think you wanted to do with your life?
I knew I did not want to be a teacher because my mother was a teacher. I had another aunt who was a teacher. My mom taught English in night school. Because she used to work for the railroad, and it was the railroad she worked for was owned by an American company, so they had trained her, and so she spoke English, and that's what she did later on. But I didn't want to become a teacher. And here I am.
May I ask when that path changed?
It changed after I finished high school, and I still had no idea what else I wanted to do. And I decided, well, let me try this. And in one way or another, I have been, I've had times that where I have not been teaching, but basically my initial degree was in elementary education. I have a certificate in school administration. I have taught primary and middle school and college, and definitely it was a process of discovery. And I realized that it was the college level that I was happiest with. It was this type of environment. And thinking back on it, it's to me, being a teacher was just being, you know, not just, but being an elementary school teacher, public school teacher, and perhaps it was that I didn't want to be.
What do you like about the college age?
Every level of education is important, but they're all important in different ways. I have, over the years, I have worked quite a bit with students who need help and support. UMBC is the great majority of the population of students at UMBC are first generation college students, and as was I, because my parents didn't have a college education either. Not all, but many students need support, need time, counseling, and that to me is one of the most satisfying parts of my job, is working with students. You know, I was talking about doing advising before for registration, and I seldom get away with any less than half an hour, and sometimes it's a whole hour with the students, because a lot of times they do need somebody to talk to beyond just, you know, getting permission to register for a class. And I do a lot of work with the Latino students at UMBC, because the two of the classes I teach are Spanish for heritage Spanish speakers. So I see not just Spanish majors or language majors, but, you know, I have engineers, people who are studying engineering and biology and information systems, and who are wanting to, a lot of times, who have not had any formal education in the language. They speak it at home. So how do we work with those students to really, a lot of times, become bidialectical, so that they're also prepared to use the language in the professions, which may be a more normative language. It's just, you know, we speak differently in our work as we do at home. Many of these students have not had any kind of, as I said, formal education in the language. So that's part of my work with the students, the language part. But also, there isn't, I think, our Latino population here is, we're scratching 5%, which is not very large. I think sometimes, but this is very good university. It's a good university especially for the sciences, but actually, and it's good across the board. And sometimes students, my class may be the only class where they are really with a number of UMBC students who are also Latino. And we do a lot of exploration of identity as Latinos in the United States. We have a great time because the students come from all over. There isn't, it's not like in certain parts of the states where one group congregates. So I'm Central Americans, Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, and lots of South Americans. So there's a lot of sharing, and we have a good time. We have fun in the class. So, as I said, in one of the classes, it's more of an exploration of who we are as Latinos in the United States through readings and other assignments. I ask them to interview their relatives and try to get into the big, Hispanic or Latino business, which everybody is so fascinated with for who knows what reason. But we also read literature more along the lines of short stories and that kind of thing, of Latino authors in the United States. So anyhow, through those classes, I become even more involved with the Latino students. I work with the Hispanic Latino Student Union, the president of the Latino Hispanic Faculty Association. I have been here for so long, when there were a lot less Latino faculty and Latino students at UMBC, I sort of became the Latino mouth and have taken on a role at the university along those lines of advocacy, and mostly it's an issue of advocacy, of not forgetting that we're here.
So. I have two questions about that. So the Spanish for Heritage Spanish Speakers, is that a course that existed before you got here, or is this a course that you developed?
No. I developed one level first, and then I saw over the years that students were not really over the years, in a couple of semesters, that students wanted to come in because they'd come in to do the language requirement, because we're the only Maryland institution that has a language requirement. So they do that and they'd like the class and they wanted to continue. So a lot of the students now will do a certificate in Spanish studies or do a minor, even if, they're studying mechanical engineering. So I went ahead and I developed the second one. And what's really nice is there are 300 level courses. These two courses are equivalent to the entry courses into the major and the minor. They can take 304 and 305, which are the heritage speaker courses, and they can continue with perhaps another three courses. They can get a minor in Spanish. and still not be in a class where the teaching is geared towards second language learners with a lot of oral language development, which these students don't need because they're orally proficient. So yes, we developed those two courses. They're upper level courses, and even if a student has never taken a Spanish course, once I evaluate their language level, they're able to come right into a 300 level course without, you know, having to go through all the prerequisite courses. So we are recognizing what they bring. We're recognizing their language. We're recognizing part of their identity academically, and I think that's very important.
So we'll just go and talk about the UMBC stuff and go back later.
Okay.
But given that you work in a university system, right, where students come and they graduate and mm-hmm. they move on, in 2007, you were a recipient of the Legends of Excellence Awards, 40 years of inspiring African-American and Latino students from the Alumni Association.
Uh-huh.
So how did it feel to be recognized by the students that you had helped throughout their years?
Yeah, it was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. I was so surprised. It was very satisfying. It was so very satisfying. It's something that I don't know if you saw in my office. They had when we had the ceremony, they had a big board and they had my picture and then a little blurb and stuff, and that's been in my office ever since. So you can't, when you come, you have to look at it. So it was wonderful, and it was wonderful because it came from the students. It wasn't just recognition, but it was my students and they're coming. I mean, they'll say I had a student who's majoring and she's finishing up, she's graduating, and she's majoring in Spanish, and she said, you know, those classes were so important to me, because they were the classes where I really, you know, felt that I felt solid in my language so that I could continue. And that is extremely satisfying to me. Yeah.
So now that you are a teacher, you are an educator, what do you love about teaching? What do you love about being in the classroom?
I think, and well, with all classes, because I also teach the pedagogy class for future foreign language teachers. It's sharing knowledge, experience, directly working with the students, hearing from, you know, what the students, what they think, their experiences, how they come to bear with what we're doing in the class. And I'm a little bit of a grandma because, for obvious reasons, I guess. And I have 8 grandchildren, so I have some experience with that. You know, sometimes it's you know, bringing them to task a little bit, and I said in class, I've been talking. We're preparing to write a paper in the Heritage students class, You know, so just really break it down to develop, because the academic writing skills is what they really, really lack, and what we really work with. And so I tried to develop strategies so that they work on different aspects of the paper and all of that. And we just finished talking about something, and I said, you know, this is a little bit like being in church, isn't it? Because I was preaching to them, you know, this needs to be done, and you need to revise your paper, and you cannot turn your paper in without reading it. And it was funny, and they laughed. And it's that atmosphere, it's that give and take that in the classroom that I really enjoy, and being able, as I said, to help and support students when they need it. So.
As a native Spanish speaker, what do you enjoy about teaching Spanish? One, to people learning Spanish, but also to students who already speak Spanish.
Well, you know, I've been here for over 50 years, and living with one native language in an environment where the majority language and what you hear all the time is in this case English. It has an effect on you. It has an effect on your language and your proficiency. I have, although, yes, I am the teacher, and I am much more proficient in academic Spanish than my students are, I still make mistakes, and they catch me on them too. And that's real. Profesora no dijo que. Yes. Profesora, el acento no va en el. Ah, sí, es verdad. You know? That's nice. I enjoy teaching Spanish, especially to this population, because I understand their issues, I feel, because I go through the same thing. So if I tell them, you have to read it to yourself out loud, because that's when your ear is going to tell you, it's because I do that. And anytime I'm writing, I try to, because things like syntax is very different in one language than the other, and then you hear it, you see it on the paper, it's one thing, and you hear it and you go, oh no, that doesn't sound right. So I think that's an advantage for me, working with these students, because basically, I came the middle of my junior high school year. So, and the dirty little secret is that I never studied Spanish again, formally. Yeah. When I was in college, they wouldn't let me, because it was in Miami, they wouldn't let me take Spanish classes. So I was forced to take French, which I spoke with a Spanish accent, which the professor really hated.
All right, we're going to go back, because I just wanted to follow the teaching path, because we had started talking about it.
I moved to Maryland in 1984.
What were your first impressions of Maryland?
I've moved so much. I went from Miami to Milwaukee to Colorado. I lived in three different cities in Colorado. Then I moved to North Carolina, and then I came to Maryland. So I was very glad to be back on the East Coast after many years in Colorado, because I was closer to family. Most of my family is not in the same city, at least the East Coast. So that was good. I moved when I moved here. I moved into the countryside. I was living in Frederick County, but not in the city. I was living out in, bought 6 acres and built a house, nothing but trees. And I lived there for 20 years. I do enjoy Maryland. I do enjoy, although Frederick County is a weird county, but I do enjoy Maryland. And then I decided I didn't want that commute. It was an hour commute, and there was more and more traffic all the time. And I wanted to be closer to UMBC. And at that point, I needed to decide, where I wanted to go. And as much as I had enjoyed being in the country, in the forest, because I really do enjoy that aspect of living, I wanted to be back in the city, and I wanted to be in a Latino environment. And I very seriously considered moving to the Silver Spring area. I ended up not doing it because the real estate prices were so high. There was no way I could afford to buy anything there. And so it was always either Silver Spring area or Baltimore. So I decided to come to Baltimore, where real estate prices are much more affordable, and where there was beginning to be a growing Latino population at that point. But from the beginning, I had said, I'm moving to city. So I did move to Baltimore City. I live in a more residential area. I couldn't go from 6 acres to a row house. That was because I needed plants. So I moved there, and I started getting involved with the Latino community here. I already was involved with the students and the student organization at UMBC. And actually, it was through a former student that I became involved with the Hispanic Commission.
Tell me a little bit about that. What is the Hispanic Commission? Where did you start working
Okay.
with them?
It's the Baltimore City Hispanic Commission. It's the mayor's commission for Hispanic affairs, so to speak. So we advise the mayor through the different offices and the different departments, on issues that have to do that affect the Latino community in Baltimore, whether it be health issues. We do a lot of work with the police department, with education, and the commission has grown a lot. I'm trying to remember when it was established, and I really can't remember now. But it must have been, I think it was about 10 years ago or so.
I was thinking 2007, around there.
Yeah, it may have
Something.
been 2007, yeah, after I moved here, yeah. Yeah, because I was definitely living in Baltimore when I started with them, yeah. So We have grown, the number of members in the commission have grown. We're 13 now. We have done, as I said, we've organized in subcommittees that focus on different areas. I'm personally involved in the culture subcommittee and the education subcommittee. I think we have been gaining more visibility. We've done things like we've been doing the Hispanic Heritage Month city celebration now for quite a number of years, but we started at City Hall begging for food from the restaurants down on Broadway. And now we are actually able to get funds from different organizations, I mean, mostly banks and businesses and stuff. So we do have a budget we can work with. We can get a caterer.
And what events do you do for Hispanic Heritage Month?
That's our main event, and it's the event itself, the celebration, and also we started, I guess it must have been about 5-6 years ago, giving awards to community members who had made a significant contribution in various categories. So we have educator, a volunteer, a service provider, and an emerging leader, which I think it's really important, and that's the best category for me as far as I'm concerned. And I am so pleased because the person, the young woman who got the award for this year, is a freshman at UMBC. She's studying biology. She wants to be a doctor, and she's going to take Spanish 304 next semester. But I mean, I did. There were a number of us who were voting for these people, so I didn't choose her. But the other thing that we have done, and we started, as I said, at City Hall, and then the Walters Museum was very gracious to offer us their space, and we had it there for quite a number of years, and it was really wonderful, and they didn't charge us any rent for the space beyond that. And our thought was, well, if we do it there, we can get, you know, community that Walters wanted, more community, Latino community members to come into the museum. And we got some of that, but not enough. So this year we moved it to the Creative Alliance, mm-hmm. which is really right within the community. And there was, we could see the difference. You know, people felt it was a matter of distance. And community members were comfortable there because they have so much programming that involves the neighborhoods around and the community that they felt very comfortable coming in. So it was very, very, very successful. We were very pleased with that. But again, as I mentioned before, the work, especially the safety subcommittee has done with the police department has been incredible. And we have, as part of the commission, we have members of very vital organizations in the Latino community in Baltimore. So Liz Alex, for example, from Casa de Marilyn, and she's the lead organizer. Well, she's actually more than that now. She's a member of a voting member of the commission. We have somebody from PNC who actually was my graduate student. It's not that we're trying to take over anything, but anyhow, we have people who are working in the health system, so it's the commission is really becoming more vibrant, and the work that they're doing is becoming more significant. Of course, now there's going to be a whole change in administration, and that may be not this change in administration, but that may be the most frustrating part of this work is that that government organizations are constantly changing. You know, we're getting a new commissioner of this, we're getting a new commissioner of that. You have to start all over again. The CEO in the public schools changes, and then they bring a whole new. So you have to start all over again, and I find the most frustrating part, because you need that consistency and develop those relationships with people, and then they're gone. Something else that we have very actively tried to do is disseminate information and announce any positions in any of the government organizations, and even government, not necessarily just city, but city related. I work with a city where they need Spanish speakers, and encouraging people getting in touch actually with people to apply for those positions, because it's so needed, and it's difficult to fill those positions. So
kind of building on that, so you live in Baltimore City, you work on the commission. What kind of changes have you seen in the Latino community, or the growth of the community in this time?
Oh, it just has grown incredibly. All you have to do is, and of course, it's all over, and it isn't, of course. In the areas where the community started growing, it just the businesses, the whole, you said the Calle Ocho, well, it's that kind of thing. It's being able to go into a neighborhood where you see that community living and working and owning businesses and that kind of stuff. And that is great. And that was not here. When, in 1984, there was not a Mexican restaurant in Baltimore. Okay, because you can't count Chi-Chi's as a Mexican restaurant. And now see what we have, you know. And it's gotten to the point that I don't live in an area where there's a huge concentration, a large concentration of Latinos, but I'm seeing more Latinos in my neighborhood. And there's a Peruvian chicken outlet that opened 10 minutes from me not too long ago. And the guy down the street in the Hamilton Bakery, his last name was, can't remember, Alonso Rodriguez. The poor man retired, which is too bad. And I'd go there and I'd speak to him in Spanish. And that's one thing that I think it's really important is I think in some areas still Latinos are invisible. Okay, so the only Latinos that some people know are the bad hombres, and the undocumented, and the gangs, and so I think it's really important to, you know, for me to walk into the Hamilton Bakery and, you know, talk to the owner in Spanish, and everybody, it wouldn't have occurred to them, okay? Because we're also the Latinos of the community, you know? So anyhow, but yeah, the population has grown enough that it's just moving out of the more concentrated area. So every area in Baltimore nowadays will have at least a Latino representation.
How did you find and build your network when you came to Baltimore City?
I had somewhat of a network because I had been working at UMBC for so long, and I knew through that, I knew people in Baltimore, as I said, because of where I was living, I tended to do more of the entertainment part, more going towards Montgomery County and D.C. So in a way, there was a little bit of discovery for me of what was Baltimore, what was available in Baltimore. Through the Hispanic Commission, I have met a number of people who, and through them, I have met other people. I have built my network probably outside of UMBC. I have built my network more through the Hispanic Commission and through that kind of work. But also here at UMBC, our Latino faculty has grown, and we, I keep very much in touch with the faculty, and we always are asked to sort of have a short meeting with any faculty that is being considered, who's coming in, you know, for during a search. And I always encourage them to look at Baltimore City as a viable place to live. And I'm very, very happy to say that our two newest faculty members that we hired year before last came from California. They're both living in Baltimore City. Felipe Filomeno, who's in another department, it also lives in Baltimore City. We have more and more faculty that live in Baltimore City. Now, these are young people, and they're getting married, or they're going to get married, and they're going to have children. And that is what's so key, is being able to keep people in Baltimore City. Young people, young families. I am forever doing PR for my neighborhood. It's a wonderful neighborhood. It's a residential neighborhood, single family homes, some huge homes that are going for a song in comparison to where they would go anywhere else. But as we know, what's key is the schools, and hopefully we can start again developing a good relationship with a new CEO so that we can help them. And also we're doing things like, for example, tomorrow there is a program that I'm not involved with, but I ended up getting involved with, where they bring in elementary and middle school kids with their families to look at the university and to see, and it's an entire day, and it's been developed with the Shriver Center, which does all of that community work and outreach. Tomorrow they're bringing in kids from and parents from Armistead Gardens, which is 70% Latino. So again, bringing these making those connections and seeing what's available and hopefully being able to keep families in the city. I think that is key. Is key.
You talked about kind of discovering Baltimore City. What do you love about Baltimore City?
I like the diversity in Baltimore City. And I like that Baltimore City is quirky and weird. There's very little of, and maybe my interpretation of traditional, but traditional about Baltimore City. It's a mix of things and people. One of the things that I really appreciate is that, for the longest time, that Broadway and the area around Broadway was the place where Latinos were coming to settle. Of course, before it had been the Poles, and before it had been the Greeks, and before, and then it was the Latinos, and then it was affluent people. But you can still, it has, you know, I always say you move to a neighborhood because you like that diversity, you like that vibrancy of different people. Don't get rid of it, you know, make it available, make it affordable for everybody to stay. And there's still that in that whole stretch. In Broadway and going up to Patterson Park and stuff, and I hope that we're able to maintain that too. And I think if anything, it's that quirkiness of Baltimore, that appreciation for the difference, that may allow that to happen. Yeah.
So you have, I kind of split up your accolades here, but all right, so in 2014, you got the Hispanic Heritage Leadership Award from the NFL.
Yes.
Are you a football fan?
No.
How was that experience for you?
Surreal. I never expected, because I'm not a football fan, but beyond that, I mean, it just, and I was never able to figure out who nominated me.
That has to feel good though, right? Yeah. That there's just so many people that you work with that you can't pinpoint who did this.
But I mean, I was down on the football field with my daughter. It's like, oh my God, it was so strange. And then I started getting emails from colleagues at the university who were saying, "Oh, I was at a game and I saw you." And they were all so amazed. But it was neat. It was really neat. I have this wonderful trophy that's next to the Legends of Excellence, and students. And the neat thing is that they wrote football with a U, football americano, and they put the accent on the U. So I'm very impressed with the NFL or somebody in the NFL. So, but it was I obviously it was an incredible experience.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, and this kind of is tying to the different immigrant communities that you have just recently named. So you're on the legislative task force. Is this an ongoing thing? Legislative task force for the
Right.
preservation of heritage
No,
lands.
that was a one-time thing in, when was it,
2008.
2008. It was a task force that was enabled by the legislature to look at the language resources in the state of Maryland. I think we must have worked for, 6 months, 9 months. And it was, this is all immigrant. It was all immigrant languages. So we had town hall meetings with different, representatives of different communities came and talked to us about the kinds of support that they would like to have the state, It was a good report. I don't know if it really informed any legislation. But it was a good opportunity to get people from all these diverse communities organized around language. And we really have incredible resources in Maryland because we do have very diverse population.
How, and I don't know if you know this, but how was Baltimore City, how representative was the diversity of Baltimore City like as compared to the state? You know, was there like a large diversity of languages spoken in Baltimore City as opposed, because it was statewide, right?
I don't know that I could give you that answer, but I can tell you that in 1984, when I moved here, that whole area on North Avenue, North and Charles, and that was all Korean. But this is what happened, and this is, going back to what I was saying before, keeping people in the city, okay? The pattern is unfortunately that people come, they settle where they can, where there are some relatives and like-minded people, and once they get settled and they're in better economic situation, then they move on. And that's what I hope doesn't happen in Baltimore City. I hope that as people become more established, they get an education, they get better jobs, that they stay in the city and continue to make it what it is now, and just that vibrancy of cultures. And there is precedent. The Greek community has a strong presence. The Polish community has not anymore as strong presence as before, but there is a lot of diversity, and there's a lot there in that Patterson Park area and where in Highland Town. There are also a lot of immigrants from West Africa, for example. So, and some are Muslims, some are not. So it's not just Latino, and knowing that a geographical area can have people of different backgrounds who are living together with those who were there before, that's something that you want to value.
What makes you happy about what you do? You know, you've been involved in a bunch of different things, and I would say that, you know, they're overlapping, the work that you do with the Hispanic Commission, the work that you do at UMBC. What makes you happy about this?
Well, I think that being a Latina is the center of my life, and that's what unites all the different parts of my life, and that's what makes me happy. It's my identity as a Latina, and my that I am blessed to be in a position where I can advocate, and that makes me happy.
What are you most proud of?
Oh, Lord. I think perhaps that, that I have been able to, I think I have, in a small way, have been able to make a contribution, and overall, but perhaps even more in UMBC. And 'cause I sort of dogged in my so.
I appreciate your humility, and I know that is definitely a theme that runs through everyone that we've interviewed. But okay, so president of the Latino Hispanic Faculty Association, faculty advisor for Hispanic Latino Student Union, member of the Executive Committee on Recruitment, Retention, and Advancement of Underrepresented Minority Faculty, UMBC Hispanic Latino Student Admissions Advisory Group, the Legends of Excellence Award from the Latino Alumni Association. I mean, you could say a big way. You know, this has been the heart of your career, and you know, you're just talking about service, but what lessons have your life work taught you?
That you can't give up. You can't. There's so much work to do, and you have to keep at it.
In what way have your students inspired you?
Oh, they have gone on to all sorts of different careers. Some are involved in Baltimore City. Others may have gone elsewhere. But just knowing, I mean, I was at the birthday party for the 1 year birthday party for one of my students. Sons the other day, and it was great because she had invited all sort of, friends of hers who had graduated. So it was this big get together, and it was wonderful, and to see that this one young woman who she never knew just what she wanted to do. And as a matter of fact, she introduced me, her mom was there too, and she introduced me as, she's a professor where I would go to cry. and she's got a good job, and she's starting an MBA, and that's wonderful. That is a wonderful thing, and that is what keeps me going.
What do you do for fun? How do you relax?
Well, I have lots of leaves. I garden. I garden. That is sometimes what saves me. Not dainty gardening, but digging holes and getting the pickaxe out and putting plants in, and lots of raking of leaves. And I, fortunately or unfortunately, I told you that that I couldn't go from 6 acres to a row house, so I bought this corner house that is 100 years old and has trees that are older than that. And I've, over these last 11 years, have made the whole thing garden on the side and on the front and this, because I finished one and then, oh, look at that. Nice. So that is really my main source of entertainment. You know, having dinner. I do, as I said, I have 8 grandchildren, but you know, the sad thing about grandchildren is they grow up. They're wonderful when they're little and they stay with you and, oh yeah, grandma, this is wonderful. I'm coming, I'm staying the whole weekend and I'm doing this, and now everybody's in school or they're working or they're doing this, and everybody has their own life. And as I said, it's what we talked about at the very beginning. What I really miss is that sense of family together in one place. And that's difficult here, very difficult.
Is there anything that you would like to talk about that I haven't asked you?
Is there anything you haven't asked me?
Can you think of anything? I know we jumped around a lot, but
you didn't ask me about my ex-husband. I appreciate it. But I imagine that will be edited.
We will not include that in the exhibition. No, I think this was great.
Oh.
This was great.
Well,